This is 1A. Happy Friday. I'm Joshua Johnson in Washington. Yesterday, January 11th, was the birthday of Alexander Hamilton, the founding father who immigrated to New York and changed the world. He came from the island of Nevis, where most people are of African descent. This is also the beginning of the Martin Luther King Jr. holiday weekend, a time to honor those who fought for equality, justice, freedom, and respect. The timing only seems to worsen President Trump's obscene and racist comments about immigrants, people as poor as Alexander Hamilton was when he came here, people who look like many of the folks Dr. King died serving. The president claims his words were misreported, but their impact on the immigration debate is where we will begin today's Friday News Roundup. Joining us for the hour to help make sense of the week's top stories is Ed O'Keefe, congressional correspondent for The Washington Post. Ed, welcome back to 1A.
Great to see you.
Stephen Dinan, political editor for The Washington Times. Stephen, welcome.
Nice to be here.
And Margaret Tolliff, senior White House correspondent for Bloomberg News and president of the White House Correspondents Association. Margaret, welcome.
Thank you. It's good to be back.
I should address the elephant in the room first of all and let you know that NPR News has made the editorial decision that that word is legitimate in this context to include in its coverage. So you may hear that word in this program or other NPR programs. If you choose to use that word in your comments, that's your prerogative. We won't ban it from our air just because you choose to say it. So whatever your questions or comments are on any of this week's top stories, feel free to email us, 1A@WAMU.org, comment on our Facebook page, or tweet us at 1A. Personally, just speaking between you and me, I prefer the guidance of Michelle Obama. When they go low, we go high. I can denounce someone's comment without demonstrating that comment, so I will not be saying it. I will tag Ed O'Keefe to be the potty mouth in the room as he describes exactly what happened.
Well, as many may know already, the president was meeting yesterday in a hastily arranged meetup, basically, with Republican and Democratic lawmakers to talk about the ongoing fate of talks around how to resolve issues with immigration policy. And in the course of the conversation with folks like Senator Lindsey Graham and Dick Durbin, they brought up the fact that this week the Trump administration decided to start rolling back what's called the Temporary Protective Status Program, which is temporary legal protections for people from places like Nicaragua, El Salvador, Haiti, certain African countries. And discussing the fate of those immigrants, Trump became frustrated and made a reference to shithole countries, arguing that the U.S. should bring in more immigrants from places like Norway. Why do we need more Haitians? Take them out, he said later. Nearly 60,000 Haitians, about 200,000 El Salvadorans, tens of thousands of Nicaraguans are benefits of that TPS program, protected by that TPS program. And in the context of the conversations, they were suggesting to the president that perhaps something be done as part of this ongoing negotiation to resolve their status and also make changes to the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program, DACA, the one that protects Dreamers.
We should note that the president has said that he did not make that particular disparaging remark, that he, but that he did use, quote, tough language at that meeting. Senator Dick Durbin, who is the Democratic whip from Illinois, confirmed the reports about the vulgar language used by the president. The audio is a little bit muffled. It was in kind of a news conference hallway gaggle. But here is part of what Senator Durbin said today.
The president interrupted him several times with questions, and in the course of his comments, said things which were hate-filled, vile, and racist. I use those words advisedly. I understand how powerful they are. But I cannot believe that in the history of the White House, in that Oval Office, any president has ever spoken the words that I personally heard our president speak yesterday. You've seen the comments in the press. I have not read one of them that's inaccurate.
That was Senator Dick Durbin of Illinois responding to the president's reported comments. And we said the president said he never said anything derogatory about Haitians other than, and I'm reading from a tweet, other than Haiti is obviously a very poor and troubled country, never said take them out. Margaret Tolliff, talk to us a little bit about just some of the early reaction to these comments, particularly why the president would say something so not only rude, but flat out racist.
Yeah, there has been swift condemnation from across the political spectrum, with a couple of notable exceptions. And as of, you know, Friday morning, we have still been waiting for some official condemnation from either the House Speaker or the Republican leader of the Senate. But beyond that, there has been a lot of outcry from a handful of minority Republican lawmakers, which I think is important to note. And of course, you know, from Democrats, from civil rights groups, from a lot of conservatives. He has gotten some, and I'll say some, public support. Steve King is one of those people. There has not been a lot of public support for his comments. There has been a range of somewhere between extreme discomfort and outright outrage from Republicans as well as Democrats. And it certainly complicates a couple of things. One of those is this push to try to find some resolution to avert a government shutdown, to take care of the Dreamers or the DACA people, depending on who you are and what you call them, but children who were brought here by their parents and are not here with, you know, papers, versus kind of the wall slash border security debate. That seems hopelessly irresolvable at this point now, a week or so before that deadline. The timing obviously is terrible, but it also comes at a couple of other important timeline points that I'll raise for you. One is this very public fallout with Steve Bannon over this book, Fire and Fury. A lot of questions about who's the real leader of that base. Is it Steve Bannon or is it Donald Trump? Would Trump move away from Steve Bannon-esque type of sort of whipping up of the base now that he separated himself from Bannon? This seems to address part of that question.
And we will get more into the book later on in the hour.
And it also comes at a time when the president is being forced by a deadline to make a decision on Iran that he really doesn't want to make and is very frustrated about, which is the idea of delaying sanctions. So I don't, these are not directly connected events, but just to give you a sense of his state of mind, some of the issues he's juggling this week.
Let's get into a little bit more of the reaction. We want to play two back-to-back clips. One is from Fox News anchor Laura Ingraham, or Fox News host Laura Ingraham. And then after that, CNN analyst Phil Mudd. They had two very different reactions. Listen.
The president was reportedly referring to the countries of Haiti, El Salvador, and of course that's the home of MS-13, mind you, and some African nations. CNN completely freaked out.
The president is growing this country on the backbone of bigotry that comes from when I saw my family called f***s. We should be ashamed. We've learned too many lessons, and history will tell you that if you don't read history, you'll repeat them. That's what our president did for us today. I am not proud.
That was CNN analyst Phil Mudd, and before that, Fox News host Laura Ingraham. Stephen Dynan, some of the speculation around these comments is that, you know, the president might have been trying to speak to or for his base, that maybe there are people politically, that there's some political reason why he said this. I tend to think that this was just kind of an unguarded off-camera moment where he, you know, he kind of...
And this was an Oval Office meeting that it wasn't public consumption necessarily. So right. I tend to agree with that. Look, it's worth looking at what happened in this meeting is that these several senators, Lindsey Graham and Dick Durbin, a Republican and a Democrat, who have been working on an immigration deal, charged by the president with working on an immigration deal, came back to him and said, Mr. President, boy, have we got a deal for you. We've worked this out and we're all good with this. We think you should take it. It comes after a meeting last week at the White House where Lindsey Graham basically laid out some of the beginnings of this deal. And the president said, go back and work it out. And then the meeting earlier this week. So series of meetings, and the deal they present to the president looks dramatically unlike what the president thought he was going to be getting. If you look at the details of the deal, it's 10% of the border wall proposal that he sent up to Congress last week in terms of limiting chain migration.
10% of the funding, you mean?
Of the funding to build the wall. For right. So it's 1.6 billion essentially out of, and he asked for 17 billion was the proposal he sent up for the border wall last week. in terms of the cut in the chain of family migration, it, at best, it's a 3% reduction. And I've heard some experts say it doesn't reduce it. It just shifts around the family categories. So, you know, the president who ran on and has made this demand for chain migration is told, Mr. President, we've got a deal for you. It doesn't look much like a deal. And then the add-on to that is, as Ed mentioned, this this temporary protected status, which hadn't been part of these conversations for most folks, and then the senators present him with, by the way, Mr. President, we're going to eliminate the diversity visa lottery that you want to get rid of, but we're going to take those visas and put that into giving a new pathway to citizenship for a different category of folks that you haven't even been talking about.
I do want to talk more about the real political implications of all this when we continue our conversation, but first I want to get to some of your comments. Danny is watching us on Facebook Live. He writes, I can't believe that for the next 24 hours, I'm going to have to look at the word S-hole on TV here and in the paper. How low have we sunk? Libby added, almost every day brings us to a new low. Emily is also watching on Facebook. She writes, while it is your prerogative to be above repeating the president's slurs, Joshua, in my opinion, it does no one any favors by masking the truth with prissiness. People need to know what the president actually said. Stephen wrote on Facebook, every day I get more and more disgusted by this man. Is it clear now that he's a racist bigot? And Emily writes, he isolates us and embarrasses us every time he opens his racist mouth. Part of that isolation includes some of the reaction from other countries around the world, which we will get to as we continue the Friday News Roundup with Ed O'Keefe of The Washington Post, Margaret Tolove of Bloomberg News, Stephen Dinan of The Washington Times, and with you. I'm Joshua Johnson. Glad to be with you. You're listening to 1A from WAMU and NPR. This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson. It's the Friday News Roundup with Stephen Dinan of The Washington Times, Ed O'Keefe of The Washington Post, and Margaret Tolove of Bloomberg News. We welcome your questions and thoughts about any of the big stories that made news across the country this week. Tweet us at 1A, comment on our Facebook page where you can also watch our video stream, or email us 1A@WAMU.org. Let's stick with this story out of Washington that we began the program with. Reactions have been coming in from various parts of the world, from Haiti, from various African nations, from the descendants of immigrants. Paul Altidor is Haiti's ambassador to the U.S. Here is what he said today to the BBC.
They pay their taxes. They have houses. Again, we've been great contributors to the American social and economic fabric. So the stereotypes, the cliches, the stigmas that Haiti unfortunately has come to be known in many people's consciousness, we're simply saying they do not add up.
That's Paul Altidor, who's Haiti's ambassador to the U.S. Ed O'Keefe, I don't know if we've begun to feel any tangible fallout from these comments. It's still pretty recent, but this cannot look good for the president's international relations, which are already kind of shaky, with many world leaders kind of questioning his ability to do this work.
Yeah, and remember, he's now planning to go to the World Economic Forum at Davos later this month, so you wonder how he'll be received.
With a lot of high rollers and big-name billionaires.
And frankly, a lot of the leaders who probably are being asked to comment on all of this today. Look, the global reaction was swift. It was, as we expected, quite critical of what he had to say. And I am especially curious to see what the leaders of those specific countries that he was referencing, whether it's the entire continent of Africa or those Central American countries that are frankly quite dependent on U.S. aid, whether they will say anything here in the coming hours about all of this. But let's also point out, as Margaret was alluding to earlier, there is support for this here in the United States. Steve King is a congressman from northwestern Iowa, a strident critic of attempts to revamp immigration policy. And this morning he tweeted, hang in there, Mr. President. If those countries aren't as you described, Democrats should be happy to deport criminal aliens back to them and anchor babies, too. Anchor babies at somewhat derogatory term, many believe, that refers to people who or children that are basically born here in the United States by immigrants. Dreamers, by another term, frankly. And King has always been one that suggests that all of this should not be done. So, look, there are people out there today, and we're going to hear a lot more about it, I'm sure, in the coming days, that are going to say that they get or they understand or they support what the president is saying here, and plenty of pushback as well.
Aaron wrote on our Facebook page, "This is just one of many horrible things that this president has said. I want to know when his administration, Congress, and the country are going to stand up and say enough already. When are the good people going to push back and say that these types of comments are not acceptable on or off the record?" Margaret Tolliff, some of this has come up before. I mean, when the president made his comments, it was about a year and a half ago, about Judge Curiel, the judge who is of Mexican descent but born in Indiana, and said that a Mexican judge could not rule fairly on matters of immigration, Paul Ryan came out and was like, this far and no farther. So we've heard these kind of comments before. We haven't really heard anything from the Republican leadership yet. I wonder if that is brewing or if GOP leaders are just kind of learning, you know, not to touch these radioactive remarks.
We have seen in recent months and weeks a reaction sort of subside or at least be very measured by Republican leaders. And part of it seems to have been the idea that their goals, and for a time it was to try to get the health care repeal or modification done. Then it was the tax bill. Everyone was all in on the tax bill. Now it's become about, you know, infrastructure or a resolution on a budget standoff, that the ability to get things done has become more important than the weighing in every day by the Republican leadership. That's been part of the calculus. There is, set aside the moral question or the obligation of a politician question for a second, there is sort of the ultimate political test of this, right, which is the midterm elections. And the calculus for the Republican leadership has been, are they more likely to be able to retain their majority in Congress if they just stand with the president and bolster him up when things like this happen, even if they're not supporting what he's saying, but if they're just not fomenting it, right? Are they more likely to be able to retain the majority? Is it possible for them to detach themselves from him, condemn statements like this? And is there any way that that could improve their standing in a way that would help them to retain the majority? This is about staying in control.
I know that we could talk the whole hour about this, Stephen, and I do want your take on kind of what happens now, but let me get to a few more comments. John on Facebook writes, "I would hope that a civilized person would never have to say such a word. The willingness to use such language in the throes of an immigration debate says a lot about our current chief executive." And C-SPAN Democrat tweeted, "Donald Trump is 100% a typical Republican, with one exception. Most Republicans have some impulse control when it comes to the things they say." Stephen, before we move on to other things, what about what happens now? There is, of course, the matter of the midterm elections, and the president has just dropped a golden nugget in the laps of Democrats to campaign
Don't
on.
Don't say and, nugget,
and,
Joshua.
Well, you got it. An item, a little don't throw me off, Margaret. It's a very difficult day. The last 24 hours have made us all very frazzled. But you know what I'm talking about, Stephen. Like, what happens now?
Well, so very specifically on the immigration policy, it does make it more difficult. In particular, Democratic pressure, immigrant rights pressure groups, liberal pressure groups had already been very wary of Democrats working towards a deal with the president on this. And this will make anything that the president will sign off on almost by definition anathema to those groups. So it definitely makes a deal on immigration over the next week or over the next several months very difficult. Beyond that, I mean, to be honest, I think a month from now we'll probably be talking about a different President Trump statement or a different President Trump snafu. So, you know, this just becomes another part of that. I don't think there are many people out there who were fans of the president who, you know, have looked past previous remarks, instances, who say this is the last straw. So I don't know that it actually makes that much of a difference for in the grand scheme. It does feed into if people were sort of, I don't know, lukewarm about showing up for elections. This is the sort of thing that will produce higher turnout for Democrats if you want to go that far.
Ed, just real quick, a week from Friday is the next deadline for the government to figure out whether it's keeping the lights on. And Democrats have been demanding that as part of those ongoing negotiations, they have to sort out this issue. So in the next few days, we're going to hear whether or not the fate of DACA is part of those negotiations. If it isn't, that puts Democrats in a very tricky spot, especially in the Senate, because you need 60 votes to move these things. Will there be 9 Democrats who want to vote with Republicans if there is no immigration deal? It's going to put that party in a very tricky spot, especially those that are running for re-election this year in states that Trump won in 2016. this may be a bad day for the president, but there's some bad days coming for Democrats, especially if they get split on this in the coming days.
Let's shift gears now to the Russia investigation and a fight in the Senate over some documents related to it. Democratic Senator Dianne Feinstein of California publicly released testimony of Glenn Simpson, who is the founder of a firm called Fusion GPS. That's the company behind the so-called Trump dossier with all those controversial and salacious details. Chairman of the Chuck Grassley, who is the chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, said the action was, in his words, confounding and will trouble or confounding and will trouble future Senate Judiciary Committee work in the investigation. Margaret Tolliver, what was in the document that the senator released? Did we learn anything new?
I think it depends on how you define new. The short answer to the question is no, but the longer answer to the question is sort of, because you begin to understand part of the sweep of how that dossier came to be, how that dossier ended up in the hands or with the knowledge of various people from, Australian diplomatic officials to John McCain to the FBI to Jim Comey, where it fits on the timeline, what Simpson's thinking was in doing the research work, what some of Chris Steele's work was about. And the controversy in part is over whether one senator from a minority party can release something that the committee and the leadership has not agreed to release. But there is a nuance to this, which is this did not involve classified information, and the person whom the interview was with wanted it out. Okay, so this is a little bit different. There's a lot of hand-wringing about whether the process can be trusted if things like this are going to be leaked, but it does make a difference whether the person who has been interviewed wants it out there and believes that it vindicates their work and their frame of mind.
Ed? I was in what we call at the Capitol a gaggle with Senator Feinstein for a few moments when she was explaining this, and she said, look, there have been too many of these situations over the course of these investigations where things are getting suppressed, and people deserve to be able to look at this for themselves and determine what is being looked into here by Democrats and Republicans. She said she wanted to apologize to Chuck Grassley, the chairman of the committee, because she meant to give him a heads up. Take that with a grain of salt. And then she said that she released it because she was being pressured to do so. When someone followed up and said, well, who was pressuring you? She and her staff immediately took that back and said, no, she wasn't pressured. But Dianne Feinstein had a bit of a week, because that same day, at the moment the transcript was being released, she was there in the cabinet room at the White House painting the president into a corner and nearly got him to agree to allow Congress to pass legislation that would just fix the situation with DACA.
There was that moment in the, you're talking about the like hour long, almost an hour long that the cameras were there for, that moment where she was interacting with the president, and then I think it was Congressman Kevin McCarthy from California.
Had to jump
California
in and say.
Reminded the president he didn't really want the clean DACA bill.
And reminded him basically that he was Republican and that was not the party's position. Right. And literally as she's doing that, the transcript had just landed in boxes of reporters. So she schooled Washington that day. And the president, rightly so, points out the next day on Twitter that she's in a bit of a political pickle herself out in California. She's facing a primary. There have been questions about whether her Democratic bona fides are going to hold up in this kind of a political environment. She disputed it had anything to do with that, but you got to think it might have been a factor.
Mr. Trump's personal lawyer, Michael Cohen, is suing both Fusion GPS and BuzzFeed News for the contents of this dossier. More broadly than that, the president has declined this week twice to confirm with regard to the Russia investigation whether he will meet with the special counsel Robert Mueller and his team. June of last year, he said that he 100% would meet with Mr. Mueller, as he has nothing to hide. Stephen Dinah, what do we make of the pushback to all of this at this stage?
Well, so the lawsuits that Cohen, the president's lawyer, filed, one of them is very interesting. It's against BuzzFeed for having gone ahead and put out the unverified dossier. BuzzFeed very clearly said, as they were putting it out, this is unverified, went a step further and said, we've had reporters trying to investigate this and they have not been able to verify it, but we're putting it out anyway. And so Cohen's question is, does that not violate standards, libel standards, if you have specifically been unable to verify this and yet you publish it anyway? At what point does that reach libel standards? You then have the president this week in the middle of a cabinet meeting where he was talking about 2018 priorities from out of nowhere say, by the way, I want to make sure that we're going to focus this year on stiffening American libel laws. And, you know, in the middle of talking about other priorities, it was definitely a striking moment. He spent as much time talking about stiffening libel laws as he did on health care in that and North Korea, for that matter, in that cabinet meeting.
As a matter of fact, since you brought that up, I was going to get to that a little later in the hour, but here is what the president said he would be taking a strong look at the nation's libel laws. He mentioned it very briefly, but here it is.
Our current libel laws are a sham and a disgrace and do not represent American values or American fairness.
That was the president speaking on Wednesday about the nation's libel laws.
Well, I would actually take issue. He spent in the transcript, he spends two paragraphs dealing with this. As I said, it is as much time as he spent on North Korea and as much time as he spent talking about health care in a cabinet meeting with all of his cabinet officials there ready to talk about, you know, 2018. It was a really striking moment and tells you where his brain is on many of these things. He really feels put upon by the coverage he's gotten, and to insert it into that cabinet meeting, it does tell us a lot about where the president's brain is.
Let's catch up with Steve Bannon for just a minute. He stepped down from his role at Breitbart on Tuesday. The former executive chairman there took heat after Michael Wolff's book Fire and Fury Inside the Trump White House credited him, Mr. Bannon, with disparaging remarks about President Trump and Donald Trump Jr. Mr. Bannon was unable to deny Wolff's claims. In a statement, he expressed regret over the comments, but did not really formally apologize. Margaret, what does this actually mean in a larger sense? Steve Bannon is one of these political players who I think a lot of us are trying to predict what his political future will be like, his political power going into the midterms. How much of an impact does all this potentially have on that?
Well, Bannon wasn't a figure that most Americans knew about a year and a half ago when he sort of came onto the center stage for Trump World. And he certainly did play a decisive role in shaping that message that helped take the president across the finish line. But ever since then, President Trump has, even when Steve Bannon was sort of having favored status inside the White House, chief strategist, President Trump was pushing back on the idea that, you know, Steve Bannon was the genius or that the credit was due to Steve Bannon. The president always had his back up about that and felt that he and only he really were responsible for his victory, that Bannon was just kind of the guy who was there. So a series of things happened, all sort of timed around, the first 100 days, the sort of limited successes, then Priebus is out, John Kelly comes in, and pretty quickly, Steve Bannon is out. But is he really out? So there's when you're President Trump, you keep your ex-advisors pretty close to your heart, no matter really on what terms they leave. And so the president had continued to have some contact with basically everyone who's been out, including Bannon. But there were questions about whether that was ebbing. And what happened with that special election race in Alabama really was a tipping point. And the president sort of began to, you know, question what he's doing. Then the book comes out, and then you see, importantly, some major money backers of Steve Bannon stepping away. The Mercers, Shell Adelson, questions about Breitbart. At that point, President Trump's instinct to sort of push back really hard, punch in the face, that kind of thing, kicked in. And that's what we've seen. But the question is exactly as you posed it, which is it really over, or is there a way back? And or does Steve Bannon have sort of a parallel way to influence elections and hold court? And I think for now, his power is diminished. He's a smart man with some backing and a very polarizing figure in American politics. And it remains to be seen how he wields influence in those key Republican primaries coming up in the months ahead.
Briefly, Stephen, before we have to break?
Yeah, there's actually evidence that's already tested the Bannon effect. There's polling in the Arizona race, and when a candidate's name is attached to Steve Bannon, her support dropped by about 10% in that poll just by attaching Bannon's name. So the backlash to Bannon among Republicans has begun.
Still to come, we will shift gears and talk about the mudslides following the fires in Southern California that have caused dramatic damage. KPCC Public Radio's Frank Stoltz joins us with the latest. And before we go, we'd love to get your thoughts on President Oprah Winfrey. Would you like her to run? A new NPR PBS NewsHour poll suggests maybe not. Stay close. Back now to the Friday News Roundup with Margaret Tolliff of Bloomberg News, Ed O'Keefe of The Washington Post, and Stephen Dinan of The Washington Examiner. Today is day four that emergency authorities are searching for survivors in Southern California after devastating mudslides that shook the region on Tuesday. 17 people are reported dead in Santa Barbara County. More than 40 are still missing, and rescue efforts are underway. Let's discuss it now with Frank Stoltz, a reporter for KPCC Public Radio. Frank, welcome to 1A.
Good morning. I shouldn't say good morning. Hello, how are you?
Good. Thank you very much for making time to talk about this awful story. Tell us about the area where this has happened. What did it look like before these mudslides, and what does it look like now?
It's an amazing area. We're talking about one of the wealthiest communities in America. Leafy, to say the least, lots of beautiful trees, most of the estates on, you know, 2-3 acres. We're talking about multi-million dollar homes. The neighborhood where Oprah Winfrey lives, we all know this by now. Just a fantastic neighborhood adjacent Santa Barbara, which itself is a beautiful community in California. It sits right along the coast, and indeed the evacuation zone now covers from the ocean several miles up to the Los Padres National Forest. So there you get a sense of the community, you know, on one side, the beautiful Pacific, and a forest on the other side.
And these mudslides have, from some of the pictures I saw yesterday on the NewsHour, they've basically washed some homes away, or kind of, it looks like, encased homes in mud up to, I think I saw one home that had mud all the way up to the kitchen sink.
You know, the climb from ocean, the sea level, to the mountains is a fast climb. There's steep hills and canyons. So these are homes that are, you know, nestled along hillsides. And so when the mudslide began, it moved fast, quickly. So you're talking about giant boulders the size of cars crashing down on homes. In the middle of the night, you know, it hit, as we all know now, around 3 a.m. And there's been lots of debate about the evacuation orders and were they sufficient. But in any case, what you're describing in terms of homes being encased, really people having, many of them, little or no chance of survival because of the hour, because of the terrain. And again, as we all know, because this is an area that was hit by the Thomas Fire, just a week or two earlier, so the hills didn't have much vegetation. So when the rain came, the flash flooding came fast.
We're speaking to KPCC's Frank Stoltz about the mudslides in Southern California. Frank, how is the rescue effort going?
Well, you know, officials yesterday said, again, 17 dead with up to 43 missing. This has been a constantly moving number. The number of missing. At one point, it dropped to 8 yesterday, and then they raised it again to more than 40. Officials have been, you know, combing evacuation centers, looking at social media to figure out who remains missing. But you know, they're now at this number of up to 43. So the rescue efforts continue, but if you talk to the search and rescue fellows, you know, hopes are quickly, you know, dying that they actually will find anyone alive. Again, because of this terrain, in some cases they're finding bodies, you know, a half mile away from where the person lived because they were swept down, in one case, all the way to the ocean. So it's difficult circumstances. Hope, you know, some folks still have hope, but, you know, we may see by the end of the day a declaration that this will move from a search and rescue effort to a recovery effort.
Before I let you go, Frank, how are people doing in Montecito? Are they upbeat? Are they hopeful that they can rebuild and that the worst is over? What's the mood like right now?
It's sad. You know, folks are sad. They're shocked. I think in particular because this, you know, is a wealthy community. These things don't happen in places like Montecito. They happen in third world countries like Haiti. And so I think people have that feeling, like, how could it happen here? And then again, as I mentioned, this vigorous debate, were the evacuation orders sufficient? Because the mandatory evacuation order went out to an area actually adjacent to the hardest hit area along Hot Springs Road. So I think we can expect a vigorous debate around that in the coming weeks and months.
One more thing, Frank, I should ask you. I don't know if it's too soon for this, so if there's no answer, that's fine. But I wonder about the response from the state of California. This is one of those budgetary issues that I think Governor Brown, Jerry Brown, has had to deal with over the years in terms of water emergencies and fire emergencies and earthquakes. How has the state been responding to this, particularly to the potential for there to be more wildfires and mudslides in California's future?
Look, this is a pivotal season for disasters in California, and perhaps for the debate around climate change. But that's a topic for another day, I think. In the past 6 months in California, we had a series of wildfires in Northern California that saw more than 40 people killed. A few weeks ago, we saw the Thomas Fire, the biggest fire in the history of the state. A fire, climatologists, I'll just insert here, say was worse because of climate change. And now we have this in Montecito. I think what we will see in California, is a debate around more resources for alert systems, because in many of these cases, you just can't get out of the way fast enough. You can't slow the fire, so you just have to issue evacuation orders fast. And that system needs improvement, so there'll be a debate around that. So the response, I think, has been praised generally because there's a good mutual aid system here. But I think, the past 6 months have been unlike any other in California in anyone's memory.
Hey, Frank, while I have you on the line, I was just going to ask our panel here about some of the House Republicans who have announced that they will be retiring from their seats. I wonder if I could ask you for just a moment about two of them that are in Southern California, Congressman Daryl Issa and Congressman Ed Royce. They're stepping down, kind of fits into this larger trend with more than 30 Republicans announcing they'll be leaving the House. Can you give us a little sense of some context about Congressman Issa, Congressman Royce? Whether this reflects something about their districts, are they getting out ahead of possibly being defeated, or has their time kind of come? Does it make sense that they're stepping down when they are?
I think we can fairly use and we should use it sparingly from the sublime to the ridiculous. We'll talk from the mudslides to Republican Party politics in California. Daryl Issa, I'll just say Daryl Issa, of course, is a fascinating figure. The congressman whose district straddled Orange County and San Diego County. He was, the car salesman, car alarm salesman, who was one of the wealthiest guys in Congress. He was a huge backer of the recall of former Governor Gray Davis and the big backer of Governor Schwarzenegger way back when. And now he's retiring. And Ed Royce was, an old school Republican, a guy who saw the United States playing an important role in international politics, a stabilizing role, advocated for engagement. And in Royce's case, of course, he's out of step with the Trump administration because it tends to be, inwardly focused and a bit isolationist in many views. So in California, the Republican Party is extremely weak, to put it mildly. Both of these districts have turned bluer. I don't have the numbers in front of me, but they're about even in terms of Republicans and Democrats. Of course, decline to state is growing as well. So there's a chance that maybe Royce's or Issa's districts will turn blue. We'll see if that happens. But I think you're right. It's part of this larger trend where Republicans who are like Ed Royce rethinking their relationship to the party and the direction of the party and just calling it quits. And in Issa's case, the same, more or less.
That is Frank Stoltz, a reporter for KPCC Public Radio. Frank, we really appreciate your time. Thanks for talking to us.
Good to talk to you.
Let's come back to the panel here. Margaret Tolliff, Ed O'Keefe, and Stephen Dynan. I saw you nodding, Ed, when Frank was describing the party affiliation in California. Interesting that these districts, many of them are turning more blue. No party affiliation is also growing for a variety of reasons. I wonder what your read in terms of Issa, Royce, and kind of the broader Republican so-called exodus.
Let's look at that. As of Issa's announcement this week, there are at least 29 House seats currently held by Republicans that will be open in November. Let's go all the way back to 1994. when Republicans retook control of Congress after decades of Democratic power, only 27 Democratic incumbents retired that year. So that shows you we've already exceeded the 1994 numbers. We've exceeded the numbers from 2006 when Democrats retook control from Republicans. This signals the incumbents know the party is realizing that a wave is coming and they're getting out of the way. Royce and Issa faced two of the marquee challenges from Democrats this year. They believe they can get three or four other congressional districts held by Republicans in California. You'd have to win about 10 more seats to make the entire Golden State congressional delegation Democratic. That's not going to happen this year, but certainly it's a sign that the Republican Party is pretty much near death out there.
Stephen Dynan, I think it is fair to say that California Republican politics have a long way to go before they're a formidable challenger to Democrats. I think that's kind of unavoidable. I wonder what your sense is of how the GOP is preparing for 2018 at this point. I mean, this seems like it's turning into history repeating, but are they learning the lessons of history, or do they just not seem to be ready yet?
Let me bring one other perspective to the retirements real quickly. Six of the retirements, but five of those retirements are from chairmen, including Ed Royce, who are term limited. The Republicans have this deal where you're only allowed to serve six terms as the top Republican on a committee. We are, as Ed just mentioned, we are 24 years out from that 1994 election. Those are actually 4 6-year cycles. So the number of retirements, it's definitely damaging to Republicans, but it's not necessarily folks fleeing because they fear their own re-election. Some of these are Republicans. Bob Goodlatte, his district in Virginia, is not going to go Democratic. He's retiring because he has to give up the gavel. So some of this is just natural attrition because of that Republican rule.
We are low on time, but I definitely want us to talk about another political story that came up earlier in the week. It's kind of a novelty, but it reflects, I think, something real about the way we view our leadership. This past weekend at the Golden Globe Awards, Oprah Winfrey received the Cecil B. DeMille Award for Lifetime Achievement. She gave a very empowering speech in regard to the Me Too and the new Time's Up movement. Here is part of what she said.
What I know for sure is that speaking your truth is the most powerful tool we all have. And I'm especially proud and inspired by all the women who have felt strong enough and empowered enough to speak up and share their personal stories.
That's part of Oprah Winfrey's acceptance speech at the Golden Globes upon receiving a Lifetime Achievement Award. NPR, The NewsHour, and Marist did a new poll that shows that 54% of Americans do not want Oprah Winfrey to run for president, including 40% of Democrats. But in a hypothetical matchup between her and Donald Trump, Oprah would beat President Trump by 11 points, 50% to 39%. Zach writes on Facebook, are people really entertaining the idea of Oprah being president? She has no experience with anything close to being president. Another, Zach, writes, if it came down to voting for our current president versus an actual self-made billionaire who actually seems to care about people, I'd vote for her without a second thought. However, I don't like the idea of Oprah running for president with no governing experience whatsoever. She could end up being the best president ever, but I think she needs to hold an elected office first. Margaret, this is a really interesting kind of Rorschach test on what we think about celebrity and leadership. She's not talking about running for California governor, which she could do this year, but this idea of Oprah 2020, what does that say?
Well, right now, this is all just fantasy land.
Right.
But there's a couple of points that I would make. One, I was talking to Doug High, a Republican strategist here in town earlier this week, who noted that in a lot of Trump country, in a lot of the white voters in Trump country, men who voted for Donald Trump, their wives, very likely, based on demographics, were Oprah watchers, steadfast Oprah watchers at one point in time, that her appeal may go well beyond the Democratic or minority base. That's an interesting point. The other is that she actually is a billionaire and could put forward records to show it.
So basically self-finance her campaign if she wanted
And is also kind of one of the original sort of TV stars, right? And also that she is a tie to Obama at a time when a lot of Democrats kind of miss Obama and there's no Obama replacement.
Steve,
let me give you two numbers. Oprah Winfrey's Twitter followers, 41.3 million. Donald Trump's, 46.5 million as of last night. And for what it's worth, the poll numbers you just read, in I think it was September of 2016, Hillary Clinton led Donald Trump by 49 to 39. So almost the exact same numbers you just read for Oprah versus Trump. So who knows what happens?
Do we take this seriously? Is this just one of those pop culture things that comes up every now and then?
Well, wasn't it 3 years ago that we were saying, should we take this seriously? Isn't this just a showbiz thing?
Well, there's that. There is that. Well, listen, I don't know about y'all. I could use a break from the news this week. I think a good place to find that is at the gym, especially a fitness club chain called Lifetime. Don't know if you heard about this, but the Lifetime fitness club chain is telling its members to remove cable news from the screens at the fitness centers. The company tweeted that the decision, quote, resulted from significant member feedback received over time and our commitment to provide family-oriented environments free of consistently negative or politically charged content, unquote.
Yeah. Just hide your head in the sand. That way you won't
just
have to know what's going on.
From personal experience, I will say this. When or if I'm ever on a treadmill, I'm always watching SportsCenter.
There you go.
Very good zen.
You know, but HGTV. If you want to get your pulse up, you know, cable news might be the way to do it.
Amen.
And keep the defibrillator nearby. Ed O'Keefe of the Washington Post, thanks, Ed.
Great to be with you.
Margaret Tolliff of Bloomberg News. Thank you, Margaret.
Thank you.
And Stephen Dinan of The Washington Times. Thanks, Stephen.
Thank you.
This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. Until we meet again, I'm Joshua Johnson. Thanks for listening. Enjoy your weekend and watch your mouth. This is 1A.